Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 17th of June, these are the main stories. At least 20 Indian soldiers are known to have died at a border skirmish with Chinese troops. The Indian Prime Minister says his country will respond if provoked. Facebook bans all foreign adverts ahead of the US presidential election to prevent political interference. And
if they'd tackled it as a normal public health issue instead of covering it up, my brother might be alive now.
China tries to silence anyone speaking about the lockdown in Wuhan. Some citizens accuse Beijing of a cover-up. Also in this podcast, the US imposes severe sanctions on Syria, which could compound the devastation caused by 9 years of civil war. And
I started to say to myself, I don't think the season will return, but here we are today and football's back, and you know, hopefully you can put some few smiles on people's faces.
English Premier League football returns after 100 days away. As we record this podcast, China and India have been trading accusations over a confrontation on their joint border on Monday, in which at least 20 Indian soldiers were killed. The violence took place at high altitude in a remote valley in the Himalayas. Beijing says India provoked the deadly clash by launching an operation into Chinese territory, and it's urged Delhi to impose discipline on its soldiers. For his part, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said his country wants peace but will respond if provoked. He made his first public comments on the confrontation in a televised address.
I want to assure the country the sacrifice of our soldiers will not go in vain. For us, the country's integrity and sovereignty is above all, and no one can stop us from defending it.
Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etharajan, told me more about the reaction in India.
There has been shock and grief outpouring among many Indians if you watch the social media and the television channels when they talk to the family members of some of the soldiers killed. People were really, really upset because this is the first time such a high number of Indian military casualties for a long, long time. And that too along the border with China, which has remained more or less calm for more than four decades, even though there have been some fist fights in the past. So that has put the government also under a lot of pressure, and all the newspaper editorials calling for, you know, look at China's relations at in a different perspective, and India needs to do something. But the government has maintained in a relatively very, very restrained position. And in fact, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi addressed the nation a short while ago where he said the sacrifice of the soldiers will not be in vain and India wants peace, but it is capable of giving a befitting reply if instigated.
Yeah, but what are the options given the fact that China is, you know, a giant military complex and a giant economy and a huge country? What can India do?
First of all, as you say, you know, militarily, Indian forces are no match for China's power, which has, you know, exponentially increased over the last two decades, the amount of money they spend. Also, the terrain, it is very high in the Himalayan region at an altitude of 15,000, 16,000 feet, where the Chinese troops have been staging war games for the last 2 years with improved infrastructure, whereas the Indians are lagging behind in terms of both the infrastructure and technology. And even if they want to escalate, how this will affect the economy. China is the largest trading partner for India with more than $80 billion trade, with the majority of the trade in China's favor. So how can they affect the economy? These things need to be considered. And also, India is struggling to contain the outbreak of coronavirus outbreak. It is already the fourth worst hit nation in the world. And the government has been spending a lot of money trying to contain the virus. So the situation is not very ideal for India, but they need to be doing something to satisfy the public pressure.
That was our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etharajan. Some notable changes are underway at one of the biggest companies in the world. Facebook says it will ban all foreign adverts placed on its site ahead of the US presidential election in November. It'll also allow users to opt out of political ads. It comes amid mounting pressure on the social media behemoth to prevent possible interference in the election. And after Twitter had started marking some tweets from Donald Trump as misleading. Facebook's Vice President of Global Affairs and Communications, Nick Clegg, admitted the company got it wrong at the last US election in 2016.
Oh, absolutely. To be fair, I think everybody, in a sense, got it wrong because no one was aware at the time what the sort of level and sophistication of the Russian interference would be. Many people were looking out for more traditional forms of nefarious behaviour, like hacking. And it was the first time that foreign organised adversaries were trying through social media platforms like Facebook to interfere with the election.
I asked the BBC's technology correspondent Rory Ketlin-Jones whether these changes are going to be seen as significant or not.
I'm not sure, Joe, that the critics will think they are. You said there were notable changes. Yes, they are combating foreign interference, but actually that was announced a long time ago. That's a kind of re-announcement that they're going to stop foreign ads. They're making adverts a bit more obvious to people. If they're shared, they will still have this label on saying they're a political advert. And yes, users can opt out of seeing them altogether. But many of the critics challenged Facebook just to stop providing this service, targeted political advertising. Last November, I talked to the web's creator, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who said Mark Zuckerberg needed to turn off targeted political advertising. He said it was a risk to democracy. And I think the critics will look at this and say, this is just not good enough.
I wonder whether some of this policy change, Rory, is related to demands from within the company. We've seen even resignations from Facebook staff complaining about the company not clamping down on disinformation and fake news from very senior sources.
Yes, what's been unusual over the last couple of weeks, following in particular President Donald Trump's remarks about when the shooting starts, the looting starts, that comment, and the failure to act on that, we've seen open revolt from staff. And it is a concern for Mark Zuckerberg. He's done a number of open meetings in which he's tried to explain himself. The revolt continues at a low level. But I think it's just effectively girding itself for what is going to be a very challenging 6 months for the company during this campaign. On the one hand, huge pressure from President Trump, and conservatives in the United States have always thought social media firms were biased against them. On the other hand, the Joe Biden campaign has issued a sort of public challenge to Facebook to combat misinformation, to fact check what's going on. And Facebook's made it clear it has no desire to do that whatsoever.
Our technology correspondent, Rory Ketlin-Jones. After 50 days without a case of COVID-19, Beijing is now battling to control a new outbreak. Restrictions on leaving the city are in place and schools have been closed. But in Wuhan, the city where the latest coronavirus originated, victory has been declared. However, as our China correspondent John Sudworth found, those who want to tell a different story about what happened in Wuhan are often silenced.
For 2 months, time stood still on the banks of the Yangtze as this city endured one of the world's harshest lockdown. Now, it seems a distant memory. Wuhan's interrupted lives have resumed again, and the famous noodle sellers are back in business. But beneath the appearance of normality, the authorities are on edge.
Oh, yeah, the coffin.
Yeah, that's the coffin.
People we arranged to meet are followed by plainclothes police, who block our car.
He wants to stop us.
And we too are tailed.
Are we being followed?
Yes, definitely. That guy's just pulled in behind us.
At this apartment block, a group of officials keep a careful eye on us. During the lockdown, anger erupted here over how it was being managed, with a national vice minister heckled on an official visit. It's all fake, they shout. Despite willing participants, our interviews are brought to an end. People may tell you something they don't mean, one official says. In a small room, in a village on the outskirts of Wuhan, a shaman is praying. Sitting opposite her is Ms. Wong. She doesn't want to use her full name, and she's here to try to relieve the guilt she feels about her brother's death. ...44-year-old Wong Fei died in early February. Ms. Wong has been told by the police not to talk to the foreign media, but she's chosen to ignore that warning.
they should have warned the public in time. If they'd tackled it as a normal public health issue instead of covering it up, my brother might be alive now.
For China, there is now only one narrative that matters in Wuhan, the undoubted success of eventually bringing the virus under control.
China is determined that this place will not be remembered for a cover-up that put global health at risk, but rather as the cornerstone of a great national victory, one that demonstrates not the weaknesses of tight political control, but its strengths.
In Wuhan's night market, business is still slow. There's only a third of the number of customers there used to be, the lady selling boiled frogs tells me. But by the crayfish stalls, there's only patriotism and praise. Chinese people united together to control the epidemic, this man tells me. You foreigners don't know how to protect yourselves.
See, that guy in the black top.
Yeah, he's going to stop at it.
Yeah, look.
They're pulling her over. Look.
But here's another difference. Outside one of the hospitals, a nurse we've just interviewed is intercepted by the police and questioned.
Nishuo.
Afterwards, she calls us and asks us to delete the interview. Despite the early accusations of delay and cover-up, the measures here were remarkably effective at flattening the curve. It may well be easier to fight a virus without the inconveniences of public criticism and democratic debate. But in their absence, might China miss the signs of the next public health crisis too?
That report from Wuhan by John Sudworth. 8 men have been arrested in South Africa, accused of involvement in one of the country's most notorious corruption scandals. Senior officials from the VBS Bank and an auditor from the international accounting firm KPMG are among those detained. Andrew Harding is in Johannesburg.
It's alleged that bank officials conspired with prominent politicians and local municipalities to steal more than $100 million. Much of that money belonged to poor rural families saving to buy homes. The bank collapsed in 2018. High-level corruption, known here as state capture, is a huge problem, and prosecutors have been criticised for failing to put powerful figures on trial. The 8 officials arrested today face charges of racketeering and fraud. South Africans will now be watching closely to see if any implicated politicians will also be charged.
Andrew Harding. The first human trials of a new vaccine against coronavirus will begin in the UK tomorrow. The vaccine, which is being developed at Imperial College London, uses synthetic strands of genetic code based on the virus's genetic material. It's one of 2 vaccines being developed in Britain at the moment. The other, at Oxford University, has already begun trials. Professor Robin Shattuck is leading the project at Imperial College.
The first part of the clinical development is to check that it's really safe because it's going to be used in the general population and to check that it induces the right kind of immune response that we would predict would be protective. But we'll move into large-scale efficacy trials in October. It depends on how many infections are ongoing in the community. If we see a lot of infections, we may get a result fairly quickly. If there are very few infections, obviously it'll take a lot longer. One of the advantages of our approach is it's very scalable. So we can make the equivalent of 2 million doses in a litre volume. So you imagine a litre bottle of lemonade, that would contain 2 million doses. And we already have the infrastructure and the plans to be able to make enough vaccine for the whole of the UK, should it be required. And we're looking to increase capacity for other parts of the world. Because, you know, obviously the danger is to develop a vaccine that works but not be able to make it. Obviously, we want to make this an accessible vaccine at an affordable cost, so we're not looking to make profit. And we think that the fastest way to get it scaled up is to work with manufacturers in different regions.
Professor Robin Shattuck from Imperial College London. Still to come in this edition of our podcast...
Overall, we have seen changes. Right now, our women are respected. It really helped us to rebrand the image of women empowerment in our society.
How a group of women selling food on the streets of Kabul managed to adapt very creatively to the coronavirus lockdown. Syria has been at war with itself for 9 years. In that time, the country and its people have suffered immense destruction and loss of life. Now Syria faces yet another economic blow as Washington imposes swingeing sanctions. They're collectively referred to as the Caesar Act, and they target businesses involved in the military, energy and engineering. Our Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen told me more about these new measures.
The Caesar Act is a set of very harsh sanctions directed not just at the Assad regime, but any group, any entity, any company, indeed any country that deals with the Assad regime in some key fields and basically all the main parts of the economy and military. And it's named after a Syrian military photographer who defected, left Syria, actually about 2013 or 14, I think, carrying something like getting on for 55,000 images of death and torture in the regime's prisons, which were, I've seen a few of them, that absolutely horrendous. And the stated intention in the act, which you can read, it's there online and it's not very long, is to stop the Assad regime attacking its own people, it says, and to encourage the development of a Syrian government that respects human rights and the rule of law.
Now, Syria is a seriously broken country. It has been destroyed by almost a decade of civil war. How can you make that worse? And who would end up paying these sanctions? Is it the Assad regime only or every Syrian citizen?
Well, the sanctions are laid out. They're a range of what is described as coercive diplomatic and economic measures. And it's down to the granular detail of denying individuals, families, visas to enter America. You know, it goes to that sort of a detail. Yeah, Syria is a broken country. No one really knows how many dead, but the UN at the moment is saying 700,000 is their estimate. Perhaps $500 billion of economic damage. No one again really knows. So on top of that, there are these sanctions, and that is the nub that a lot of people who may well support pressure on the Assad regime and would like very much for them to go are actually saying, well, hang on a minute, it's already got a broken economy. And on top of that, it's also now in the last couple of months in a very deep economic crisis with the currency collapsing, that bringing this in on top, it's, you know, it is the proverbial sledgehammer to crack a nut. And any life left in the Syrian economy will go as a result of this act if it is implemented to the letter.
Jeremy Bowen, our Middle East editor. The Interior Minister of Catalonia has said he would expel any police found to have been involved in an alleged racist attack. A judge in the Spanish region is investigating claims made by a young black immigrant who says members of the police were subjecting him to racist insults. Here's Danny Eberhardt.
The alleged incident took place in January last year during a police eviction operation near Barcelona. Spanish media have published the sound recording, which the young man, identified as Wubi, said he'd recorded on his mobile phone. In it, he can be heard being racially insulted, and he's told to run further than Africa next time he sees police. He can be heard screaming and says he was kicked and spat on. Six agents are currently being investigated. They've been relocated but not suspended.
Danny Eberhardt. In the United States, protests have swept the country since the death of George Floyd 3 weeks ago. There's been much criticism of President Trump's reaction to the demonstrations, including his decision to deploy the National Guard onto the streets of America's cities. But what do people think in the rural heartland? Our West Coast correspondent Sophie Long has been travelling around the Midwestern state of Montana to find out what those who voted for Mr. Trump in 2016 now think of their president. Her report begins in Bozeman, where people there were celebrating the president's 74th birthday.
God bless President Trump.
Prayers for the president on his birthday, preceding a horseback parade in celebration of him and all he's achieved, before hundreds of cars driving convoy, taking things up a level.
Happy birthday, President Trump! Love you from here!
Happy birthday!
And this is Bozeman, a relatively liberal, politically mixed city nestled under the Rockies.
He deserves a chance. Democrats cut him off at every angle. And he's a great president if they could just see that, like we do. We believe in him.
I am Hispanic. I'm Mexican-American. But I believe in the wall.
because I believe that we have to take care of our people first. I understand that America is a melting pot and that's how we started, but we're not a new country anymore.
Will you vote for him in November?
I'd vote for him forever if they'd let me.
150 miles east in Billings, lifelong Republican Rachel Simonson tells me Donald Trump has turned her to the Democrats.
I think he is just an awful human being. He is unkind. He is self-centered. He does not have America in his heart. And as a woman, to see how he talks about women and treats women, that is offensive to me.
Some think he is, as they say here, all hat and no cattle. Others, like Bill Bullard from ARCAF, which represents ranchers, had high hopes in 2016, but feel the president hasn't delivered on his promises.
We were convinced and continue to be quite convinced that the president would respond if he understood that he was listening to the wrong people in Washington, the very same people who were pursuing a global agenda rather than an agenda that would help put America first, as the president said. So we've been trying to urge the president to begin putting America's cattle ranchers first, but he's yet to do that.
A few days ago, I was watching thousands of people protest on the streets of Los Angeles, angry with the police and their president. Now I'm walking in the remote foothills of the Rockies in Montana. It is stunningly beautiful. When you come here, you realise this is a completely different world. And when you speak to the people that live here, you realise many still have total faith in their president. Brad Kraft is harvesting hay to feed the cattle on his ranch. He and his wife Lori were ecstatic when Donald Trump was elected, and they think he's doing a great job as president.
He actually was a businessman, and we're business people, so we was, you know, overjoyed, actually.
I think, too, we were impressed that he had a touch with rural America. He didn't underestimate our intelligence, which often happens.
Even in the industrial heartland of Colstrip, a city which grew around the now partially closed power station and the coal mine that feeds it, where the coal workers' jobs Donald Trump vowed to fight for will almost certainly be lost, support for the president remains strong.
Thank you.
The Rusty Zippers, a group of retired coal workers with the old rancher and engineer in the mix, meet for breakfast once a week at Rizzo's, a stone's throw from the mine.
I think he's done well, and I hope we can keep him. But boy, they are working hard at getting rid of him. But I think they forget the old silent majority still sitting here, and I'm one of them.
What do you think about the way that President Trump has handled the protests that have been seen on the streets of cities across the United States?
Personally, I believe he could be a little more aggressive. I don't believe that any place in this country that people should be able to throw rocks and Molotov cocktails and kill people. That shouldn't happen.
Montana's ranchers and coal workers may be struggling more than they ever have, but those that support Donald Trump tell me he offers them what no Democrat does, the hope of being heard. And that hope now, just as it was in 2016, could be a powerful political force.
Sophie Long with that report from Montana. The COVID pandemic has ruined countless businesses across the world, but for some people, it's brought new opportunities. In the Afghan capital, Kabul, the lockdown meant that dozens of women who made a living selling snacks in the streets were now out of work. But they didn't stay jobless for long because they converted their solar-powered food carts into mobile disinfection units to help tackle the outbreak. Fatima is one of them.
When I first started selling food in the streets, I was harassed constantly. I was made fun of by many people, but I and my colleagues who run the food carts just kept going. And over the time, we witnessed a change in people's attitude towards us. They have accepted us and realized that there is nothing wrong with women running a food cart. During the lockdown, we turned our carts into mobile units, providing people with free hand sanitizer, clean water and soap for hand washing. This helps us to gain support from local communities.
The person behind the project is Farhad Waji, the head of Ebtekar, a social enterprise NGO that helped around 80 women set up their mobile food cart businesses. He spoke to James Copnell.
Street food vending business is a typical man thing in Afghanistan. because it's a pulling of the cart. So for that reason, if someone sees a woman pulling the cart or a business which has interaction with men, so it's not very normal. It's not seen very appreciative by the society.
And when you set this up, how did you manage to convince women to give it a go then?
I figured, let's involve women into a male-driven occupation if you want to break the decades-long stereotypes about Afghan women. Couldn't find any woman for like 3 months because, you know, everybody would tell me that, oh, how would we do that? You know, it's really strange and nobody has ever done that. So when I convinced one lady and when I involved her into this traditional food cart business and when she started serving street food, she was confronted with really harsh reaction from the society. She resisted not only for the sake of herself, but for the sake of other fellow Afghan women. So seeing this one lady enabled us to recruit more ladies for the job. So right now we have recruited 80 women for the 40 solar-powered food carts. And we have received 610 applications from ladies to do this job.
And now with this coronavirus pandemic, they've had to change now into mobile disinfectant units. How does that work?
We were in lockdown. The government stopped every business to stop the spread of virus. So for them, it was really hard to survive in an economic lockdown. So I came up with an idea to provide free disinfection and free sanitation services to those people who cannot afford buying expensive sanitizers and expensive, you know, hand washing soaps. So that was my two mission, and fortunately, I sent a lot of proposals to UN, to other organizations, but because they have some bureaucracy, I was only supported by one organization. It's a part of Afghan government. It's the National Procurement Authority. So they accepted my proposal, and we placed six of the carts inside the presidential palace as well. The only issue we have in Afghanistan is the cultural issue. They wouldn't be like looking into suspicion if a man was doing this job, but they might be thinking that, you know, it's a Western backed idea of woman empowerment. So let's not buy from her. Overall, we have seen changes. Right now, our women are respected. It really helped us to rebrand the image of woman empowerment in our society.
Farhad Waji, the head of the Afghan NGO Ebtekar, speaking to James Copnell. And finally, here in the UK, Premier League football returns on Wednesday, exactly 100 days after it all stopped due to the coronavirus lockdown. 92 top flight matches will be crammed into the next 40 days. Sheffield United and Aston Villa will kick off the restart to the season, while Manchester City host Arsenal later today. Our sports correspondent Alex Capstick reports.
The Premier League is back. It follows the return of elite football in Germany and Spain. And just like in those countries, it will look and sound very different. No fans, no spitting, no handshakes, physical distancing during goal celebrations, medical staff wearing protective clothing. The environment for the restart has to be as safe as possible. The long list of rules, therefore, understandable. Those running the game seem prepared to take whatever action necessary to get the show up and running again. It was that or risk losing hundreds of millions of dollars in television revenue. The negotiations have been long and complex. The chairman of the Premier League is Richard Masters.
We've been in a huge consultation process, trying to get clubs collectively agreed on how to do it, bringing players and managers alongside, working with government and medical experts. It's been some undertaking.
There are concerns the restart, just 3 weeks since contact training was allowed to resume, has come too soon, that the players just won't be physically prepared for such a compressed schedule, which will see all 92 fixtures completed by the end of July. But most seem happy to be back at work, although, as the Manchester City striker Raheem Sterling explained, at one stage, as the pandemic claimed more and more lives, returning to action didn't look possible.
At first, you know, I didn't think it was serious. I thought it would be something that would be 1 or 2 weeks. And then, you know, day by day, you're getting the reports and seeing how drastically the numbers are going up. I started to say to myself, I don't think the season will return, but here we are today and football's back and, you know, hopefully we can put some few smiles on people's faces.
A minute's silence will be held before the opening 12 matches in recognition of those affected by the virus. In another sign of solidarity, the players' names on their jerseys will be replaced by Black Lives Matter. The stands will be empty, but clubs can broadcast live pictures of fans watching from their homes on giant video screens. Richard Masters hopes to get them back in the stadiums as soon as is practical. Discussions, he says, are underway. Meanwhile, he hopes the football will provide enough excitement to help all of us cope with the new norm.
Alex Capstick, our sports correspondent. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or any of the subjects we've covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham, and until next time, goodbye.